You're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
The Dutch artist Henk Panda arrived in Portland in 1965 and, except for brief periods, has lived here ever since, creating works that challenge the status quo of modern art in the Pacific Northwest. In his drawings, watercolors, oil paintings, Panda depicts subjects ranging from the death of friends to erotic fantasies, from the wreck of the New Carissa to the ruins of Ground Zero, and from the skylines of Portland and Amsterdam to abandoned airplanes and automobiles in the American West. My name is Greg Widet. You're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpod.com. Now, it's not every day you get to meet a major contributor to Northwest art. Today, our special guest is Henk Panda, and we catch up with him at his Southeast home.
Henk Panda, nice to meet you. We're at your home here in Southeast Portland, and we're trendy now. We're on a podcast, so you're kind of a trendy guy right now.
I am.
Yes. Podcasts are a big thing now, so... by the way, thank you.
I feel very trendy lately. So.
Well, thank you for showing me around your studio earlier. It's a lot to take in. And it's a house and it's a studio.
Yeah, it's a small old Portland bungalow. It's built in the early 20th century, I think 1904 or so. Beautiful old little house.
Right.
And then I used to have a large loft in the northwest on 18th and Upshur, like a huge place, which was great. And I had that for many years. But then rents became sort of extravagant. And at the same time, we had this backyard, which was only used for the dog to shit in, so to speak. So, and in the neighborhood, sometimes people started building like little buildings behind their houses. And somehow it struck me that it would make sense, since interests were relatively low, to build a studio behind a house. And through the neighbors who had also built a really nice little building here, they introduced me to a really very nice and relatively inexpensive contractor, who then recommended this young architect, this young 31-year-old woman. And so we discussed this thing, and so we came to the conclusion that we just build a tower behind a house rather than, you know, a large flat areas to build like sort of like a layered, and then build it to the maximum height which was allowed. So the whole thing is really within the parameters of what is allowed in this neighborhood. And then in order to get enough footage, we also went downwards about 12 foot down into the earth, and then built kind of a vault there for storage. The problem was, when they built it, it was like built in 2004, they dug this huge hole, and it was in like in the winter, and it was raining. It was just raining like crazy, and they had to build this enormous hole here, and it filled with water. And the purpose of this basement basically was to store paintings, and the basements are notoriously dangerous for painting stores. And then as I dug it out here, they discovered there was a well, even. Water would bubble up right out of the ground. So
yeah, it's a big problem in Northwest.
Yeah, yeah. So so anyway, we had a geoengineer come out, and we found kind of a solution. They built a kind of a drainage pattern and added, you know, the drain towards the sewage down there. It cost a lot of extra money. And they put in a sump pump. And so,
we have to have a sump pump.
Yeah, it's a sump pump.
Oh my goodness, you do have a water problem.
However, about a year ago, some young woman came by, and I had like, I don't know, hundreds of big paintings in there, like years worth of work. Also, all my watercolors and drawings and frames and all that. This young woman came by in the neighborhood and said, "You know, I've always been curious about this addition. What is it?" And I said, well, it's my studio. You want to see it? I said, sure, I'd love to see it. So I said, well, just like I did with you just a bit ago, I said, well, I'll go downstairs and then we'll show her the whole plant. So that was kind of my plan here. So I went downstairs, flip on the light, and there would be like 2 feet of water from one end to the other. The whole vault was completely flooded. And my paintings were like, you know, so a lot of them were really underwater. And it ruined like all my mats, a whole lot of my drawings. It ruined all my watercolor frames. And a number of early paintings are still not restored. Anyway, it was just sort of devastating. Restored all the paintings and brought them up to actually better than they looked before. And a lot of the paintings are not here anymore. I put them in a different kind of storage facility. I put in a brand new high-tech super-duper sump pump, which I check with a whole bunch of extra pumps and a generator and everything. Because
well, you know, I bought two houses in the Northwest, and the one thing that realtors always tell you is don't buy a place that needs a sump pump. But you know what? Sometimes it just, you know, it happens. I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah. And, you know, and you have these blackouts, and then they have no power. So I have a generator outside, which I can, and a power line going to the downstairs. So in case it be, I can turn on the generator and still have power down there. So testy.
Yes. Oh, downstairs, you have this amazing painting. Can you talk about that? It's this woman laid down. This woman laid down, and she's in a provocative pose.
It's one of a group of four paintings I painted last year. You know, I'm not getting any younger, so you know, I'm sort of facing, you know, the end game in a way, and so do a lot of my friends. And so, this particular person, I had a girlfriend. She was a very nice woman whom I had known, whom I, you know, got involved in after my wife died. She lived on the coast, and her best friend were together. I made actually a double portrait of the two of them in 2013. And, you know, my friend on the coast, who was a really nice woman, she had sort of mental problems occasionally, and then one night she got in her car, and she lived on this farm out there. She got in her car and sort of missed the gravel road and drove straight into a drainage ditch with her car and all, and got out of the car, fell in the water and fell backwards and drowned. And so there was this sort of like sudden death of, you know, another close intimate of mine. And so her friend, who's really quite ill herself, she's got diabetes, she's got, you know, problems with her kidneys, and she's a really, you know, also kind of fading. And she was in the 60s, she was a, you know, follower of musicians, and she was a kind of, you know, in a decadent kind of world of the 60s. She was a real example of that kind of period when I came to this country. And now she is this aging person who is also sort of struggling for her life, but still sort of retains that sort of 60s
sensuality
about her, at the same time sort of facing, you know, her own mortality, and sort of, you know, in sort of projecting out in it my own. And so she offered, after my friend suddenly passed away, she said, you know, if you'd like me to, I would pose for you. And so in a sense, I sort of projected onto the death of my friend and painted her friend in this body of work. So I did a number of paintings for her where she was in an extremely vulnerable position, and at the same time painted her extremely carefully with, you know, as much empathy as I could bring into it. So the paintings are kind of like, in a sense, you know, it sounds sort of melodramatic and stuff, but I come out of Holland, and there's some quality about the history of Dutch painting and its humanity and its sort of humanism in it, and it's sort of, you know, dealing with like actual life itself, and, you know, not only its gloriousness of it, but also its ultimate, you know, its sadness as well, that kind of combination of loss, but also living in spite of all the struggle you have, that kind of quality, and at the same time the history of like figure painting, and which goes back like, you know, many centuries, all of that together, and fine art and working from nature, and all these sort of layers get into this painting. So that painting comes out of, you know, this little program I had. So it's one of like, I painted four paintings of her, and then I had some other younger people pose for me as well, also in the same period. So it's last year has been kind of a time of like portraits and figure paintings, but kind of in a penetrating kind of, you know, in a penetrating kind of way. I'm well aware that these paintings, you know, in the kind of current political climate, may be somewhat disturbing, but I have to, you know, being somewhat of an outsider here, I can't always deal with the, you know, the pertinent American politics about what should be and should not be painted, so I kind of ignore it.
You describe yourself as a reluctant immigrant, even though you've lived in the United States for many, many years, but you still have this incredibly thick Dutch accent.
I'm not aware of my accent, but it goes up and down.
You know what I find is cursing in American? It sounds really great. It's such an expressive language.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing you said in one of your interviews is that you felt sort of like you landed in Mars when you first came to America, Portland.
Well, it's, you know, the truth of the matter is, being an immigrant nowadays under the regime of this neo-fascism, it's sort of like, it's kind of dangerous to be an immigrant. You kind of run a risk. I mean, they could, even they are threatening people to take away their, I'm a naturalized citizen, but I'm still, you know, a suspect in a sense. And so coming from a, you know, when I came here out of the Netherlands in the mid-60s, I was completely fully formed in the Netherlands. I was a well-educated. I came out of an artist family. I was came out of a long...
One of 10 children.
One of the eldest of 10.
How did
My
you
father
find
was a really
food?
Fine artist.
Right.
I grew up in the art world. I grew up around Dutch painting. I went to the State Academy of Fine Art, which is like, you know, a superb school at the time. I had a lot of friends in the Dutch art world who became, you know, really, some of them became really quite high achieving artists. And I sort of formed early on a kind of a model about what kind of art is fine art. You know, I think in your early years you get to form a kind of idea about what is fine painting. And so when I came here, in the middle of the Vietnamese War. There was an enormous amount of turmoil here. There was like huge demonstrations. There was enormous conflicts. There were like, you know, people being killed. I taught here. Students were hauled out of class and they had to, you know, be inducted into the American Army and stuff. And it was just an enormous amount of stress and tension. And the only war I remembered as a little kid was the Second World War, which was, you know, occupied Holland. And there were kind of elements during that period of like, which reminded me in a way of like the war, the only war I remembered. So being also coming here, being really poor, and all of a sudden being thrown into this really very different culture, and being completely naive and utterly unprepared for it. And at the same time, I said, you know, I'm an artist. What am I supposed to do here? You know, I came here because I met this girl in Holland and she is from here. And we had these little kids and all that. So I moved here by sheer, coincidence, nearly. And at the same time, there I was. So I had to sort of say, well, what am I going to do here? You know, and so the local artist out here was sort of a, you know, kind of an in insider little world of friends and people who worked here together, very much influenced by New York art and concerns in American painting. And
right.
I really very little to do with my own background or who I am or how I perceive myself to be in this culture. So
wasn't it fortunate that your wife knew Mike Russo? I mean, wasn't that a stroke of luck?
Yeah, well, it was through Mike Russo. When I met her, she was traveling through Europe and she was on her way to Rome. And we met in Amsterdam and we just sort of spent some time together, and then she went off to continue her journey down south. And I said, well, bye. It was nice. So she went off to her trip. So sort of in there, while she was on her way down south, she got sick and sent me a letter and said, you know, I'm sick and I'm in a hospital or whatever. And so she was in Paris. And so I felt, you know, bad. So I went down and checked it out, how she was and all that. And I decided, what the hell, maybe I'll go with her to Italy. I'd never been there. We'll hitchhike together. So that's how I got to Rome and met the Russos who were on sabbatical there. And then through their contact, after we got married, that was a contact we could make here in Portland where I could apply for like a temporary teaching position. So that's how
you made your name here basically all on your own by creating all kinds of controversy. Correct?
Well, I didn't create it. I mean, I think others created it for me.
Yeah.
I didn't create controversy. I'm actually rather chicken. And I'm certainly not out there to, you know, confront the world. I mean, I came here basically penniless. I had $50. That's all I had. I didn't know a soul here.
Yeah.
You know, it was terrifying, basically. And I started making drawings about how things had struck me out here. You know, like I drew the world around me. And
tension.
I was told when I was a little kid, when I was a young artist, people said, all you can do as an artist is paint your time, you know. And I found myself here, and that was my time, is to start documenting it and drawing it. And So the fact that it was controversial had more to do with, I think, lack of exposure on people out here than my own background, because I, you know, grew up in Amsterdam.
That
and
makes
seen
sense.
A lot.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I watched your Oregon State Capitol Foundation interview twice.
You did.
It was gripping. It was moving. It was touching. You talk about your personal experience with Governor McCall. I really got a sense that you bonded with Governor McCall as you were doing his portrait.
Yeah, I did. In general, when I paint portraits, I, you know, generally do research about who am I painting, you know.
Right.
So I want to know about, you know, it's not like sort of painting a still life, but you paint a real person. So I want to know about their backgrounds and their interests and who they are and how they perceive themselves.
It's great rosé, by the way.
So... So in that sense, you know, especially a serious commission like, you know, like in for the state capitol, there was a lot of pressure at the time too, you know.
Oh, I got the sense of that too, yes. Mm-hmm. You talked about that extensively.
All these commissions are that way, you know, so.
But this one is especially, I mean, it's going to be on, you know, on display at the capitol. And he's a beloved political character. Mm-hmm. He's a larger-than-life character.
Yeah, I painted him kind of larger. Yeah, I painted him kind of, no, not lighter, it's life-size painting.
Right.
But when I met him, you know, I still remember. I went to his house and all, you know, and the Secretary of State was there. There was some other bunch of attorneys there and stuff. And I just, you know, I was sort of somewhat like intimidating sitting. And, you know, and I had to sort of, you know, confront it. So, and down the stairs comes this really extremely tall, extremely handsome, really incredibly good-looking and very, very nice man sort of walks into the room. You know, he's like, I'm short. And he's just this incredible man, you know. And I thought, the first thing I thought, you know, he'd be great in a life-size painting, you know. And so that was my first thought about it. I should paint him a life.
You sold him on it. So, you sold them on the idea.
Yeah, yeah. Not only that, he's tall in the history of Oregon.
Yes.
And he's a
Vicar Taylor and Governor McCall.
You know, and in his history, what he did for the Oregon environment and how he perceived, you know, like protected the landscape here.
Yes.
How he described his, you know, I read his biography and there were like things he's a really great storyteller. And so he told about himself and he stood on the coast and he lied through his nose, but he had a 16-foot pole and it measured the dimensions of the, and he never stood there with a 16-foot pole, in other words. he was there with a bunch of, you know, I've seen photographs of it later with a whole bunch of, you know, people and oceanographers.
That video, they focus on the hands a lot, I noticed.
Pardon?
Did you watch that video? They focus on the hands a lot. His hands are reaching out. Now, Governor McCall is reaching out. It's a very warm gesture.
Yeah, well, he was a charismatic individual, and he would actually naturally
reach out
to people. In fact, he would, you know, I heard stories about him that he'd be in an airplane and he would walk around the airplane and say, "I'm Tom," you know, and talk to the passengers and all that. Who the hell is Tom? But he was, you know, outgoing, gregarious individual. And so when I met him, I got that sense about him, you know, and I just was very, very likable.
And he'd call you late at night?
He called me late at night, yeah. He called me, you know. He's sort of, I don't know, I was a stranger, and at the same time, I was going to paint him, and he was going to...
Very intimate thing.
...live forever in this Oregon State Capitol, on my account.
Yeah, you mentioned that twice.
It was somewhat intimidating. This video. But at the same time, it meant a lot to him, so...
Yeah, that he's going to live forever through your painting.
Yeah.
Now, that's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So, but... I don't think Audrey McCall really liked that painting very much and actually talked to Doug Goldsmith into taking it down.
Right.
And so it was taken down for a while. I always liked Governor Kitzhaber a great deal, too.
Yeah, can you tell us what that experience was like?
I thought he was a really excellent governor. And it was his fourth time he was governor here. This is very impressive. I liked him a great deal. There aren't really that many portrait painters around, and it's sort of out of style kind of thing to do. And but I grew up in a world of portrait painting. I won the Therese van Dyl Schwartz Portrait Award in the Netherlands. My father was a portrait artist. Some of the greatest portraits in the Rijksmuseum are commissioned portraits. I think that portraiture is really a great form of expression. So, and I had a tremendous amount of experience in doing portraits, and so I had hoped early on to create kind of a portrait culture here, so it would be a way for me to also create income, to get portrait commissions. And also I had heard that a lot of local artists had said, over my dead body, I'm going to paint a portrait because, you know, I paint abstract art or I'm progressive or whatever. So I thought there would be kind of a market for it. And actually when Metropolitan Learning Center started out, I made like children's portraits for like $3 a head. And I painted in one weekend, I painted like 30 children's portraits, all in color. So all these portraits sort of appeared in the community and stuff, and that kind of started rolling.
Elevated your name brand,
momentum in that sense. And ultimately, I ended up painting some of these really, you know, high-end portraits sort of in a tradition of like...
Your take on Kitzhaber? What was your take on this guy? Was he also gregarious? Was he...
No, he was shy. Actually,
shy.
He was a very shy, very quiet.
He sat down with you for 3 hours, correct?
Yeah, there was a meeting some years ago. There was a meeting and there were a number of artists. I think there was five of us. And I I called about it, and I was not contacted about it at all. So I called Norma Paulus, and I said, hey, Norma, I'd be really interested in painting kits already. He said, you already painted a governor. I said, well, I said, I didn't know there was a rule that one artist could only paint one governor. Is that true? And she said, well, no, that's not true. No, that is not a rule. But, you know, I'm not going to be involved in it. So, okay. So I started kind of lobbying for it.
Really?
And he was
into it?
I lobbied for it, and then I was introduced to Sharon Kitzhaber at the Portland Art Museum, and so I talked to her, and I said, I'm really interested in painting your former husband. So she said, well, let's have lunch. So I had lunch with Sharon Kitzhaber, and then a number of other people who knew him, I sort of contacted and I sort of lobbied for it. And so I ended up being one of that group of people.
So lobbied, meaning salesmanship.
I sort of, you know, promoted myself because I really wanted to paint it. Because I thought he was
really quite good,
cool-looking
yes.
guy, you know.
Yes.
He's in his blue
that
jeans.
Big mustache.
He wasn't dying. You know, he was healthy. You know, Kitzhaber was, you know, I painted a lot of people who were sort of on their
he's
way out
guy.
Of life and sort of, and they're like, let's paint him before he dies. But Kitzhaber, you know, was just not,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And he's a handsome, you know, really nice looking, and a very American governor.
Very American.
Sort of look, he yes. would not look like a European at all. I mean, the way his hair was and the way he sat and the way he dressed and in his jeans and his cowboy boots and his sort of attraction to the Oregon
pure
landscape.
Americana, right
Pardon?
There. Pure Americana.
Just incredible, yeah.
yeah.
I thought he was just an incredibly beautiful subject. And also, I really liked his politics. You know, to make a long story short, ultimately, that took a long time for Kitzhaber to make up his mind whether he even wanted to be painted. And then finally, I got a call that he wanted to meet with me. And so I started making drawings of him when he gives speeches and started making studies of him. And then I had him standing, giving, you know, with a projection. I thought that looks too much like McCall and all that. I didn't want to paint McCall number two either. So ultimately, I painted him seated. He was also, you know, he's sort of a cross between a naturalist and an intellectual, that quality of also about him. He was a doctor. And the fact that he was a doctor, that he was like, do no harm, a healer, that element of him, that he was like an emergency doctor who then became the kind of healer of Oregon. That really spoke to me as a theme, to have a physician, to have a doctor, to be the governor of a beautiful state of Oregon and to preserve it and save it and heal it. I thought was a really very moving aspect of his governorship, which appeared to me. And I also painted him with his doctor bag and his, blood pressure cuff and sort of the attributes of his doctorship in there. At the same time, I talked to him about, you know, the rivers and protecting the rivers. And since he was from, you know, the Grants Pass area, I painted the Rogue River landscape in it as a kind of, his, you know, not only was he from there, but his connection with the river. So, you know, I did a lot of, you know, sort of, I thought about her and I had a lot of feeling about her. And when he posed here, he said he had never been drawn in his life. And so he thought it was kind of like magic what he did. And he said he's like painting like a sculpture.
I'd like to talk about Jakob Panda's film, Painted Life, which is a documentary about you. And this is a wonderful film. What I've seen of it, it's a beautiful, quiet, subtle film, you know, beautiful segues, and really yeah. It just tells the story of you.
Well, it was sort of interesting. Jakob had always...
He's a talented filmmaker.
Yeah, he's really, you know, both Jakob and Arnold are just extremely talented. Arnold can draw so incredibly well. I just, you know, I'm just sort of takes my breath away how well he can draw.
Really?
And it's so rare to see people have this incredible ability to draw. Just,
is that inherent in the DNA? I mean,
it, to some extent, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have like a number of siblings, and I have like
right.
9 brothers and sisters.
Yes.
Some of them can draw extremely well, but not all of them.
Really?
I have my cousin Peter, my father's youngest brother, youngest son, is one of Holland's most well-known figurative artists, for instance. Just extremely his books
Peter.
Out and his work and stuff. He's just Peter, very well-known. My niece Klaartje, my brother's eldest daughter, extremely fine painter. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, artists in our family, and that drawing ability sort of pops up within the family, and has for, you know, maybe it's a century and a half. I mean, there's other artists earlier in the 19th century who were, you know, like Pier Pander was at the turn of the century the Netherlands' most famous sculptor, for instance. You know, it was all book art, his museum and his work and all that. And he also was like, my dad was a kind of a skipper's son who had this natural ability to draw, just draw really well, and was sort of guided into art schools and ultimately became this extremely famous, highly admired sculptor. So, first artist to do the pre-Rome.
What do you think of their comics? Do you read their comics? The
well,
Panda
yeah.
Brothers,
I mean,
they're kind of a big deal in the comic book world.
I mean, I didn't really grow up in a comic book world. I grew up in a literary world. So, you know, we were in a world, academic world. So, you know, a lot of my brothers and sisters are all like university. I mean, you know, I'm a reader. You know, you look around, I have books everywhere. So
there's a few books here.
Yeah, we're a reader, reading kind of family. American culture is sort of like a, you know, an acquired taste for me. But my boys, you know, they grew up here. They're totally like, they fit in here. They grew up in this culture and they're totally assimilated into it. They're born in Holland, but they don't identify as much with the Netherlands. I can't help myself. I'm still really, the Netherlands in Europe is still very much part of me. But they have more of a, that American idiom is close to them and sort of they grew up with that.
But you are familiar with the comic books. You have,
absolutely,
you have looked at
them.
Yeah.
What do you think? In fact, I modeled in them. I posed for them.
Really?
I've been involved in a film. Jakob did a film called The Operation, which is his erotic film they shot in my studio. They used to allow me to draw like plants in the
an erotic film?
Books.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah,
it
was
an
erotic
film.
Jakob did an erotic film called The Operation, and it won in 1975 the New York Underground Film Festival. And it was a film which was shot in my studio. And Jakob and his girlfriend were protagonists, although Jakob had written the script for it. It was based, the original idea came on a painting of mine when I was involved with astronomy and started looking at things in infrared light, because infrared functions so extreme in astronomy, in the science of astronomy. And so to looking at the world in a different light, in a different kind of wavelength, in a sense, our eyes are limited. So I started looking at how you would see the world in infrared. And I did painting about that, a number of paintings, actually. And so that idea of infrared sort of got into their consciousness. And they were, at the time, living, or had been living in San Francisco, and I went to some place where they were promoting
convention,
some whatever marketing,
right?
Projectors and film and high technology and all that. And they
right.
went there, I think it was in Oakland, and they saw a Japanese outfit and they were promoting this $250,000 high tech surveillance infrared cameras. And they said, oh, that would be so cool to shoot a film in infrared. and so to see the heat of bodies and all that. So they talked to these guys, and they said, well, we are filmmakers, and we're very interested in your products, but we'd like to sort of see if it would work for us. Maybe we could maybe do some test film with it. And they, you know, these Japanese were extremely nice about it. And lo and behold, like a couple of weeks later, this extremely expensive piece of equipment appeared in my studio, this huge camera. And so they shot this movie there. This, you know, yeah, Jakob and his girlfriend, and, you know, and they have basically erotic film, having sex. And I walked in there early in the morning, and Jakob and his girlfriend, they were all like pale and just completely, totally worn out. And Arnold was like, this was incredible, this was incredible. And Steve Doughton, you know, operated the camera. These guys were all like totally thrilled. And a girlfriend and Jakob were all kind of pale because they'd been doing this thing all night. And anyway, they made this film, and Jakob shot this, you know, edited it down to like 13 minutes, and they had to show it into a film. And then they submitted it into New York. And the story was that film got on the screen, and you could hear a pin drop because people had never seen anything like it. Because these bodies, they look like molten metal. You know, like liquids, glowing bodies, and that. But any kind of thing which was cold or wet would be
blocking. Sounds intriguing. Stuff.
It was just incredible. You know, so a vagina or a penis would be blown out white, for instance, of the heat. But like snot and, you know, water and, or, you know, saliva would be black, and the ears would be black, and the noses would be black, and be at night and stuff. It was just incredible imagery, you know. Mm. So there was an enormous amount of sort of cross influences between Jakob and Arnold and I. So, and the same with these comic books. I think also their concern about, you know, contemporary experience, you know, reflecting on their own personal experience in a kind of historical setting.
They strike me as hyper creatives. I mean, they're involved in many of the, you know, many of their artistic realms too. I mean, film, advertising, mm-hmm. and art, other art projects too. They each have their own website, and they have a lot of other things going on too. Mm-hmm. That sort of hyper creative, you know, environment, that's something that you've encouraged.
Yeah. And I grew up in this world, you know. But whenever little, I was involved in Storfen Theater. So
that's
when
right.
I did an enormous amount of big stage sets, and I started at the end, I was doing these really huge high-tech productions of like Lindenberg projectors and enormous Mylar mirrors. And then I had Jakob running some of these projectors and stuff. So they were, you know, really very, very close in that whole world, or the world of the performing arts and set building and projections and filmmaking and acting and writing and all of that. It was just sort of, they just sort of grew up with that. Yeah.
And what's your relationship with the Portland Art Museum now? They have a few, I mean, they have some of your drawings there.
Oh, they, yeah, the Portland Art Museum actually owns, they purchased like a major painting of mine last year. They have a lot of my work, actually, and they have some of my finest paintings, actually, in their collection.
On the fourth floor?
Well, you know, they have an enormous storage facility.
That's right.
So, but yeah, they own some of my, they own some very fine paintings of mine, and they own quite a lot of drawings also, and then people donate work. I don't even know what they have, but it's considerable. My connection with the Portland Art Museum waxes and wanes because of their enormous staff turnover. So all of a sudden, you know, there's a whole bunch of new people there. I have no idea who the hell they are. So you'd have to, you know, every once in a while, you have to completely, totally re-establish a relationship with them.
And the Russo Gallery, do you visit the Russo Gallery?
Well, I was
regularly.
With the Russo, I was, they represented me. Until like 2 years ago, Laura was a really close personal friend, and she and her husband at the time, actually in the 60s, moved to Amsterdam for a period of time, and actually through my connections and my friends there, actually set them up, and they lived for like, you know, like a whole year or longer when I had these little kids out there. In Amsterdam, and I became, you know, Laura became really close friends with my brother Arnold, and so we had this close connection. And then ultimately, you know, Laura was a little bit skittish about my paintings because they thought about the, quote, market out here. My large paintings weren't really, they were difficult to sell, and I admit they are. but, you know, I became part of the Laura Russo gallery, and then Laura Russo passed away, you know, regretfully. Around the same time, my wife died also, so, and they were closed. They actually talked to each other while they were both dying. And then Martha became the director, and Martha had a slightly different, I'm a very wonderful woman that runs a really good shop there, but we parted ways a few years ago. And so right now I'm kind of on my own.
You showed me a sketch downstairs.
Pardon?
You showed me a sketch upstairs, kind of a macabre sort of image. That's you're working it into an oil painting. Can you tell me what that is you're working on right now?
Well, currently, in the last period of time, you know, the gallery system, or the, you know, there's a quote market, and the market is really determined by the Portland clientele, the people who buy art out here, which is, you know, a kind of culture on its own, which is not necessarily the kind of culture I'm from. So there's oftentimes kind of a disconnect between how I view what a painting should be in my mind and what the trends are and what people actually like and feel drawn to out of their own point of view. There's oftentimes a disconnect. I also like to make paintings, you know, coming out of like large urban areas, which have a kind of scope to them and, you know, a scale to them. I like making paintings which have some dimension. Just to be in the studio and work on a painting is involving and absorbing. And I follow kind of the things I see in my own mind is what I think are, you know, relevant and important paintings to do. And I don't like painting trivia. I don't plan to make painting cute. I don't like painting things which are follow the trends. It doesn't really interest me at all. I come out of another kind of point of view what it is like to make paintings. And I like to make paintings which have something to do with something. And also it's somehow respond to the way I perceive my life and the world around me. And also, I have a kind of a reasonably good sense of art history and about, you know, fine art, fine drawing in my own mind. And so all that together, and having this long experience here in the United States, all of that gets into my work. And at the same time, I also, especially in the 60s when I came here, I just sort of freewheeled a lot on my imagination, on my, you know, things which sort of came out of my feelings about things and about, you know, the mood of stuff. And that sense was, you know, suppressed out here. Said, well, that work is bizarre and weird and all that. Why don't you do some, I love your flowers and stuff, you know. And I'm, you know, I like flowers like the best of them, but it's basically extremely boring. And so, you know, I thought, you know, that pressure, that sort of subtle, understated pressure, making small things about accessible work, non-confrontational or abstract or following trends, just flat out doesn't interest me. And so I thought I should take a break from that and sort of start, you know, entering my own imagination and see what happens without having that kind of outside, subtle, understated kind of pressure in order to survive. I thought, well, with portraits and occasionally making a sale, I don't need much, so I can sort of do it. So I mean, over the last couple of years, making a lot of drawings like I used to make, like in the 60s, except more informed and more, you know, more serious in a way. And then, of course, the times are really, you know, changing, to quote Dylan Thomas. And now we live in the time of Trump, and we live, you know, I grew up when I was a little kid, there was fascism. There were really, you know, there were Nazis running around. We were in occupied Holland. And I see these kind of language and these kind of trends all of a sudden rising to the surface. And I find it really not only terrifying, but it also confirms something in me that say, you know, that fascism is always in kind of suppressed, like, but it's always there, and it doesn't really take little for it to rise to the surface and become right out front. And so that quality of the kind of how the times have sort of changed so suddenly and so dramatically, and at the same time also my experience in my own life with, you know, my friends dying, and so there's kind of a serious period, and that quality is getting into my drawings.
Isn't it's that sort of more really inspiring, like, you, though? Isn't that? I mean, I know it's macabre, but isn't it also inspiring? In a negative and positive way.
Well, I mean, because I love making drawings, so I you know, ultimately,
even if it's a negative impetus. The fact that
I don't really feel. I think that the only one of the few things, at least what I can do, is make quote art. And I think that to take, like, you know, life is really not riddled with a great deal of meaning, and a lot of things are, you know, meaningless and either that or indifferent. And then in order to give grace to the living experience is to make art out of it, to give it some sort of transpose it into some kind of image which has some sort of meaning for which you can read into and recognize yourself in. And in that sense, I think that the only thing there is really which gives grace to life is making art. And so By taking something which is really maybe even dark and ironic and gripping and shouldn't be there, and making a drawing of it is recognizing it and giving it grace by making an absolutely exquisitely beautiful drawing of it, for instance. So I don't feel that. I don't feel art making as a negative. I feel it as being a very positive, life affirming thing to do. I do have a website. In fact, right now, the only way one could actually see my work as it is available is on my website, since I am not, you know, being represented by any of these little, you know, art stores. It's www.hankpander.com. And it's a wide-ranging website. My assistant, Kayla Newell, who lives here, who has been my assistant here for the last 5 years, has put the website together. She also has made a complete catalog of all my work from, like, 1948, believe it or not, until now. Every work which could be followed or photographed or slides which could be scanned, or all work which could be tracked down is in a fairly extensive, detailed catalog as well. And so if anybody would be interested in, you know, looking at that, would have to be really something really special, because it's not like for the general public. So, but there's a website. The website includes the drawings, it includes watercolors, it includes oil paintings, and it has some film material in it, it has a resume and all that and stuff. And it has a lot of current work in it. So, however, it's all like little digital pictures, and doesn't really show much about the scale and the texture and the richness of the work at all, but at least we do our best. I also put occasionally work on Instagram, and I have, like, a professional site on Facebook as well, you know, Hank Panner Visual
Yes,
Artist.
You do. I love your updates, by the way. Yeah, that was, it's very exciting to see how your work evolves.
So, you know, we keep it sort of updated, and thank you, Kayla, for doing all that. She's a whiz at it.
It's essential nowadays.
So, you know, so we try to be kind of, you know, live in this modern world as much as we can. So,
Hank Panda, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast. My name's Gregory Day. This is pdxpod.com.